You're listening to Ideas Energized, powered by LARDA Institute. I'm Elizabeth Uhl, Senior Programs Associate for LARDA's Ag Practice Department. We just launched ideasenergized.com, where you can find our blog, this podcast, webinars, and event information highlighting the latest innovations in science, technology, and more. Subscribe now to stay informed about all things LARDA Institute. We are a Los Angeles-based nonprofit organization whose mission is to work with entrepreneurs to bring their innovations to market and transform their ideas into solutions that feed, fuel, and heal the world. To learn more about us, visit LARDA.org. And now, here's episode 13.
So my guest today is Liebe Dera from Blue Forest Conservation. We're going to get deep into an extremely meaningful and interesting innovative solution that we could use for a variety of different purposes. But let's start with a topic of some current concern and some current anguish. The wildfires in California have displaced thousands of people, have uprooted lives, have destroyed habitats, have consumed dwellings across the state, north and south. But we're also in search of solutions as we see these issues dominate our lives over the next several decades. It's in defense of solutions like that are drawn from the ingenuity of people that we're devoting the company Blue Forest Conservation. Liebe Dera, welcome to the Ideas Energized podcast.
Thank you for having me.
One of the critical issues that we've been consumed by in these discussions about the wildfires, Lee, is the notion of the loss of forests, the damage and destruction done to forests. And I want to get to talking with you about two things. First of all, what does Blue Forest Conservation do that is focused on the health of forests, specifically because we are living in a time of some considerable stresses on forest land?
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, the team that brought together this remarkable innovation. So when you're talking about what Blue Forest does on forests, talk about the model that you're using to be able to establish some ways of dealing with this incredible multifaceted problem. So let's start with then asking you about, what it is that you how does Blue Forest Conservation impact the issue of forest management? Because that, as you know, is a big deal right now, in particular, topically now, in the management of these wildfires.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I co-founded Blue Forest, and I apologize, I'm from the East Coast, so you have to hear me say forest over and over again. I co-founded Blue Forest with my partners almost 4 years ago as a way to use financial innovation to drive sustainable impact. And what that means to us is we have a thesis that environmental conservation is a value and not just a cost. You know, we often think about how much it costs to do some sort of conservation work, but if we take forests, for example, the air that we're breathing right now, the water that we're drinking right now, the water that's used for our crops, jobs in rural areas, recreation, that all comes from healthy forests. And we often take that for granted, especially right now we're in Los Angeles. We're not necessarily all that close to a forest. But that doesn't mean that we don't rely on healthy forests for some of the most basic of our human needs. So clean air and clean water, obviously very important. So protecting forests is also incredibly valuable, and the costs of not protecting those forests can be quite steep, as we're seeing today. But unfortunately, we've gotten to a point where these resources are at risk. Fire seasons are getting longer, they're getting more severe. Anyone who lives in California or pays attention to the news here in California already knows this. And there's obviously a huge social and environmental cost to this. People are losing their lives. People are losing their homes. Habitat is being destroyed. The carbon emissions associated with large fires are causing issues all over the state. But there's also a huge economic cost also. And, you know, I have a finance background, so I like to think in terms of dollars and cents. So in terms of the economics, every year the Forest Service spends over $2 billion just to suppress fires. And studies show that suppression is less than 10% of the actual total cost of wildfire. So when you think about water supply in California, we get 2/3 of our water from the Sierra Nevada mountain range. So when there's a wildfire, it affects that water supply. You also think about the cost to rebuild, the tourism dollars that are lost. And when you add it up, the cost of wildfire really is astronomical. And there are a lot of factors contributing to today's wildfire crisis, and climate change certainly is one of them. But as you mentioned, forests are also overgrown and need to be managed. And it's counterintuitive, but more trees is not always a good thing. And I know that goes against everything we ever learned as kids, but having an overgrown forest actually increased the risk and the severity of wildfire. So removing some of that excess growth, we're talking small trees and shrubs and doing prescribed burns, that can actually reduce the risk of fire. And I want to take a second, you know, we're not talking about logging. That's shown to increase the risk of fire. We're talking about proactive forest restoration. This is what the Forest Service wants to be doing more of. Countless experts and environmental NGOs all endorse this as a proven approach to decrease the risk of wildfire. But surprise, surprise, it's not being done on the needed scale.
But that's also partly, Lee, sorry to intervene.
No, go for it.
But also partly because budgets have been under severe pressure. There simply aren't the available resources necessary on a proactive basis
exactly.
to take care of all our forests anyway, without some kind of collaborative kind of instrument that is what we're going to be talking about here in a minute.
Exactly. And that and that's where I was hoping to get to was that, you know, with the Forest Service spending over half of their budget on putting the fires out, they don't really have any money left to prevent tomorrow's wildfire. So we are literally taking the funds from the preventative side and putting it towards the suppression side and borrowing money. But, you know, I use air quotes because it never gets repaid. And it just creates this vicious cycle. So given that it's the federal government, they don't have the funds necessary to be proactive. If we go back to thinking about the value of protecting ourselves from wildfire, protecting our water, protecting our air, protecting our rural communities, that often far exceeds the cost of restoration. So think about back to the Forest Service. If we do restoration, they can save money on fire suppression, among a host of other things. For utilities, they care about their water supply, and restoration can actually increase water quantity in some areas. And it also protects it from sedimentation and debris and water quality issues. It protects their infrastructure like power lines. And for the state government, they care about rural economies, carbon emissions, the health problems from wildfire smoke, rebuilding communities. And, you know, depending on the location, there are other beneficiaries like railroad companies, ski resorts, cannabis farmers. Some of these beneficiaries will be more fun due diligence trips than others. But what's important to note is that there are a lot of different groups that are affected, for better or for worse, by forest health. So I know that that's a lot, and I still haven't told you what it is that we do yet. So let me just back up for a minute. I'm someone who comes from the investment world. And the whole idea of investing is that you put some money up front. That money is then used to create value by the company you're giving it to, or the solar farm, or whatever it is that doesn't have the money on its own and it needs your capital as an investor. And then you get that money back at a later date, ideally with some sort of return. So then let's look at the wildfire crisis. Wildfire seasons are getting worse. We have a proven approach to decrease that risk, but a lack of capital is preventing us from getting this work done, even though restoration creates more value than it costs. So if it walks like an investment and it talks like an investment, why can't we make this into an investment? And I think that's partly because people are intimidated by finance, but I'm going to let you in on a little secret. All you really need to know for a successful investment is that you have to get out more than what you put in the first place. And that's exactly what we're doing at Blue Forest with the Forest Resilience Fund. We are fighting fire with finance. And the way we do that is we take private capital and invest it in forest restoration, and then have the different groups that benefit from that restoration repay investors over time. So I can walk you through an example to kind of help illustrate what that means. So let's say that it costs $100 to restore a forest. It obviously doesn't. I wish it did. If it did, I'd probably be out of a job, but that'd be a good thing. But for simplicity's sake, let's say it costs $100. we work with our partners like the World Resources Institute to figure out who the beneficiaries are of that restoration project. So for a lot of projects, it's going to be the Forest Service, the state government, and a utility, if not others. So we then work with those different groups. So the Forest Service, for example, and we say, hey, we're going to put $100 into this restoration project. Can you pay 50 of that? And then we go to the state government and say, we're going to do this restoration project. Can you pay 40 of that? And then same thing to the utility, and we ask them for maybe $25. And each one can set up their own timeline for repayment, and no one group is ever paying even close to the full amount on their own. But we've just taken $100 and turned it into $115, which is enough to repay investors their principal, plus what would equate to a 4 or 5% annual return over 5 years. And that's not just hypothetical anymore. In October, we closed our first Forest Resilience Bond project in the Tahoe National Forest. It's a $4 million project, which is pretty small in the grand scheme of things, but we plan for this to be the first of many across the Western U.S. And the reason why this is so important is because we as a society are severely underinvesting in forest restoration and environmental conservation more broadly. Every year, we spend about $50 billion investing in the environment, most of which is coming from public and philanthropic sources. And, you know, that sounds like a lot of money, and it is. But reports show that we actually, just to protect our environment from a changing climate, we actually need to be spending over $300 billion every year. So that's $250 billion every year. And governments and philanthropic dollars just can't be expected, nor should they, to really be able to make up that difference. So that's where our approach comes in. If we think about the value that conservation provides, and if that value is greater than the cost, then maybe we can make up some of that conservation work into an investment to close that $250 billion gap. Because we found that investors want to play a role in building a more sustainable future. We just have to give them the tools. And the Forest Resilience Bond is now one of those tools.
So let me dive a little deeper.
Yeah, please.
So who identifies these projects in the first place? I think the appeal here clearly, because you know most bonds are sort of for single user entities that are going to be benefiting from the bonds.
Right.
What you've done is you've spread this across multiple stakeholders, bringing them together, creating an instrument where they can all participate, right?
Mm-hmm.
And based on the specifics. So it's this whole concept of to each according to his need and from each according to each according to their ability and from each according to their need or whatever that the case might be. The point is you've customized an instrument that will have multiple stakeholders participating in one instrument. What is your role as Blue Forest, as the issuers, if you will, of this bond? What is your role and who identifies the projects?
Yeah, so we think about our role as really the ones kind of putting all this together. So we are issuing the investment. We're raising the investor capital. We're coming up with the measurement methodologies and making sure that the measurement is being done. We're drafting the contracts. Of course, all this is done with partners and people that have much more experience than we do. And we're also working with all the different beneficiaries and bringing them on board. It's really important to us that these restoration projects, they come to us from the local communities, from the Forest Service, from the nonprofits that are active in these regions, because we don't want investors or even the perception of investors dictating restoration work on the ground.
So the investors don't have a say in where their investment goes.
Absolutely not. Okay. What happens, so for our first project in the Yuba Watershed in the Tahoe National Forest.
That's just started, right?
We already closed that. We closed that last month. And for that, the way it worked was we have been working closely with the Forest Service for a few years. And working with them and some local partners, we asked them where might be a good fit for the Forest Resilience Bond model. They took out a map. They looked at a couple different high priority areas. They pointed to the map in the Yuba Watershed and said, here, this is where we think would be a good project. So we had some introductory conversations with investors to get them familiar with what the model was.
Sorry to interrupt. Yeah. Who were these investors that you went out to?
Yeah, so we had introductory conversations with lots of different investors. We're not talking about venture capital. We're not talking about private equity. What we're talking about is foundations, endowments, insurance companies, impact investors. And we had some preliminary conversations with them, but we didn't actually raise capital, ask for any sort of commitment until all of the environmental planning was done and the project was shovel ready and really just ready to move forward. And that's for a couple of reasons. One, you know, we don't want to take on investor capital until we know we can use it. But also, again, back to the governance. It's really important that investors aren't dictating any of the actual planning of the restoration work on the ground. So once that was all buttoned up, we worked with the beneficiaries to get contracts written to figure out who's going to pay what and how it's going to work over how many years, what we're going to measure and what those payments are based on. And then we take those contracts to the investors and say, hey, you know, we talked to you about a year ago and told you what this was about. You seemed interested. Well, here's an actual investment opportunity. Let's dig into the details and see if you're interested. And so we ended up, again, it was a $4 million project. We had $1 million from each of four investors. And we're really thrilled with the investors that we're working with. So two are foundations, the Rockefeller and Moore Foundations. They've given us grant money to help support the development of this work. And these were program-related investments from the foundations. So it's a below market rate return and it counts towards their 5% of grant making as a foundation. So it's really a win-win for them where they get to invest in the pilot of a program that they've been investing in through grants. It counts as a grant, but they get their money back plus a modest return. So that's two of the 4 million. The other 2 million, one is an impact investor called Calvert Impact Capital, and the other is an insurance company, actually, CSAA Insurance, which is part of AAA Insurance. And they lost a lot of money in the Northern California wildfires last year. So for them to be able to say to their customers, hey, we're not only insuring you against wildfire, but we're taking your premiums and we are actively investing that in programs that will help decrease the risk of fire in the first place.
Be proactive, yeah.
Exactly. So it's really a win-win for them and really for all investors. But I think there's a huge potential for the insurance companies to invest in something that diversifies their portfolio, gives them a competitive return, and then also decreases their risk on the insurance side.
So the bond platform that you are developing, Lee, is that going to be attractive to groups beyond the so-called impact investment community?
Mm-hmm.
Is it in fact going to appeal to folks who say, for example, invest in munis and municipal bonds or
mm-hmm.
infrastructure bonds or city bonds? Do you think
yeah.
that kind of case can be made, broadly speaking, to include those kinds of investors? Because it is an infrastructure
mm-hmm.
project, effectively, right?
Absolutely, and we've already seen it. We had to turn investors away from our first project. There was so much interest. And if, you know, $4 million, it sounds like a lot of money. In the investment community, it's really not that much. So we definitely had more interest than we were able to accommodate, which is a good problem to have, but that also means that that's a wasted opportunity. You know, I like I said, I come from the investment side, and to know that there's money just sitting on the sidelines that wants to be investing in our communities and investing in our environment, and it's not because the investment opportunities don't exist. That's really what we're trying
okay,
to get at. And not just us, but, you know, I really hope other people and other groups do the same, because there's so much more money interested in these types of investments than there are investments that can accommodate that.
I mean, ideally, this could be, for example, a listing on a multi-asset sheet that is enabling individuals as well, like us, for example, right, to
mm-hmm.
be able to invest in an infrastructure holding kind of company that is investing in these things. And those people could be your investors, for example,
mm-hmm.
downstream. That would be a phenomenal way to increase civic engagement and impact
mm-hmm.
projects of the kind that you are talking about here. And I'm just looking forward to like this being on a list of kind of, you know, IRA type.
Absolutely.
You know, multi-asset choices that I could make for my IRA or for
mm-hmm.
any other kind of investment I'm interested in. It's a great prospect for that. I wanted to get to something else in relation to your vision to creating these sort of financial instruments, and that is your team.
Mm-hmm.
Because as we always say at Lara, you know, in interest and investment is placed on individuals and people, not on the object of their interest.
Right,
In other words, on the jockeys, not the horse.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to know about your backgrounds as a group, because you've got Wall Street bond experience, you've got structured finance, you've got impact investment, you've got the Peace Corps.
Mm-hmm.
These are all sort of characteristics of your team, and I wanted to get that. How did you come together? What was your backstory?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we always joke that the story of how we started as a company sounds like the beginning of a bad joke. And it's a Wall Street banker and a Peace Corps volunteer walk into a bar. But, you know, that really is how this started. So me being the Wall Street banker, my co-founder being the Peace Corps volunteer, and then, as you mentioned, another co-founder who has experience on Wall Street, more on the structured finance side, and then our fourth co-founder who has everything from impact investing in renewable energy to working over in Iraq, as he won't really tell us, and I think that means he was a spy. So really a little bit of everything. And we all came together because we all went to Berkeley for business school. And, you know, I came from the investment side, and I really liked finance, and I am a total spreadsheet nerd. So it was a great fit for me, but I didn't really have the passion for it that I wanted in my career. So I went to Berkeley specifically to transition from regular investing to impact investing. And that's where being in business school and a school in particular like Berkeley, where you have people coming from such different backgrounds and where things like social and environmental impact are such a big part of the curriculum, where you just really get to meet people that are also interested in a lot of the same things you're interested in, but from a totally different perspective. And so if you don't have the water resources engineer / Peace Corps volunteer saying, oh, wow, like these fires are really terrible. It's really a shame that there's all this work that could be done to prevent it, but it just doesn't get done because no one can pay for it. You know, making that comment to someone who has a finance background, who has no idea how forest management works and what forest restoration is, and all these are new concepts, but you know, if you tell me that there's something that can create a lot of value and there's lack of upfront capital, then of course, you know, wheels in my head are going to be turning about how that could be an investment. So it's really about kind of bringing those perspectives together that created what was at the time seemed like a crazy idea. And it probably still is a little crazy, but we've been doing it for almost 4 years now.
So why do you think these opportunities haven't existed before, Lee? I mean, the notion of, you know, of finance professionals, of people with finance backgrounds who are also interested in impact,
mm-hmm.
is not a particularly new one, right? But why has this kind of investment opportunity or opportunities
mm-hmm.
not existed before?
Yeah, I think about that a lot. And I think there's probably two main things. The first being, this takes a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of patience. We spent nearly 3.5 years to do one project. So we've been fortunate to get grant funding to cover our costs, but we haven't earned a dime off of this, and we didn't take any fees on the pilot. We probably will in the future take fees on projects, but at the end of the day, we're talking about working with utilities and the federal government and asking them to change the way they do business. That takes a lot of time, and we've gotten to the point where we have a great relationship with the Forest Service, and they're very proactive about wanting to invest in stuff like this and wanting to engage private capital, and they just didn't really know how before. But you know, it took us a good 2 years until the Forest Service really was like, okay, you guys aren't a bunch of crazy MBAs, and maybe this is something worth looking into. And so that takes a lot of time. And I think the other reason is because when you think of trying to address climate change, you hear a lot about policy and technology. And those things are incredibly important. Like, I'm not gonna shortchange them and say that that's not a big part of the equation, but I really firmly believe that finance is the third leg of that stool, and it doesn't get anywhere near the attention that innovations in policy and innovations in technology do. And that's really a shame, because it's not just it that means that people aren't thinking of it, and if they do think of it, it's hard to get grant funding. We were really fortunate to get connected to the Rockefeller Foundation pretty early on, and they have a team dedicated to funding innovations in finance. It is really unusual to find a foundation that wants to give grants to people who do finance. And, you know, we're a for-profit and we have this financial model.
Yeah.
It's not a traditional grant application. So it's hard to, not only is it hard to do and it takes a long time, but there aren't that many groups that are willing to fund that. And so I think when you, I'm hoping that by talking about this more and hopefully being a success story, that it really helps other people think, well, you know, there's a potential here to use finance to help solve these problems in addition to all the great work you're seeing in policy and technology.
Silly, you know that people keep saying, and this is a true statement, by the way, that there's a huge amount of liquidity and money that's in the marketplace looking for opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Given the short lifespans that we all have, frankly, you know, people also think about legacy, right? You've got people like Mo Ibrahim in Africa. You know, you've got great industrialists who are philanthropists and visionaries in Asia. In the U.S., of course, you've got a ton of people like Bloomberg and Gates and so on, and Warren Buffett. We've got unique problems here, but they're not so unique that we can't express those kinds of impacts worldwide. So you've got, for example, the soil health issues here that will transform the way we think about farming. You've got wetland issues in Africa, which are a buffer against pollution and a whole bunch of other things. You've got issues of air quality and the mitigation of air quality in Asia. And you've got, you know, some things that have been tried, like carbon credits and so on and so forth. This is a more proactive, get engaged kind of project, a set of projects that you're thinking about or solutions you're thinking about. I totally agree with you, by the way, Lee. It's not about technology. It's about solutions. We think that that's important in the context of the work that we do. It's not just about technical proficiency, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I want to ask you, you know, how does this get translated beyond a group of people that you're currently working with to include other kinds of projects that have great social impact or social relevance that have to do with people's lives and habitats and so on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, we think about that a lot, and that's why at Blue Forest, right now we're working on the Forest Resilience Bond, and that keeps us plenty busy. But our tagline is financial innovation for sustainable solutions. And we would like to really expand upon our offerings and use this model. You know, at the end of the day, we're talking about a financing model. We're talking about using investor capital to cover upfront costs and then having the different groups that benefit from that reimburse investors over time. There's really nothing specific about wildfire to that. So so there's no reason why this model can't be applied to other contexts. And I think that's a big reason why groups like the Rockefeller Foundation have supported us. They want to see us be successful, of course, but they also want to see the market for conservation finance really develop. And so whether that's using our model, Blue Forest using our model in other contexts, or whether that's helping to catalyze and inspire or help move along other groups that are trying to do conservation finance work around the country or worldwide, you know, that's really what we're trying to do.
So, I mean, just a quick notion here. So you're a for-profit company, and that's an important aspect of the work that you do, because you have to see yourself as being sustainable as well as an enterprise. To the extent that you're introducing, I'm so sorry to be so puerile about this, but to the extent you're introducing competition, right? But your model may very well be used by other people who could be competitors to you. What is your sweet spot in all of this, and how do you think about that future? Because obviously you want to be able to scale this as well.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be able to have many more projects that would give you a core of stuff that says, you know what, Blue Forest Conservation is the go-to group for all of this.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think about the possibility of all that competition coming in?
Yeah, we don't really see it as competition, and that I think that goes back to the stat I gave earlier that we're investing $50 billion a year, but we need to be investing $300 billion. So there's, you know, I think, I'm not sure, I hope in my lifetime that I get to a point where we are worried about competition, but right now there's plenty to go around. We could probably stay busy just doing the Forest Resilience Bond in California for the next 30 years.
Okay, so, sorry to interrupt. I just want to, because I should have asked you this before, but I want to get into the mechanics and the guts of the Forest Resilience Bond, the FRB.
Mm-hmm.
Give us the scenario, right? Specifically identify what happens with the Forest Resilience Bond. What is the origin? How does it continue? What happens at the end? You've got this beautiful animation on your site, which explains it, but I'd like to be able to see if we can have our listeners visualize the Forest Resilience Bond
mm-hmm.
as conceived by Blue Forest Conservation.
Okay, that's tough because I'm also very happy with how the animation came out, and I'll see if I can.
By the way, blueforestconservation.com, in case you wanted to be able to see the animation. But I'd like Lee just to be able to give us a sense of that, right? Just it's such a compelling story.
Thank you, and so it is a bit complicated. So that's one of the reasons why we wanted to use an animation and really break it down to make sure that people understand it. It goes back to taking $100 and getting $115 out. So for our first project in the Yuba watershed of Tahoe National Forest, we have a couple different beneficiaries, as we call them. It's the Forest Service, it is the State of California, and it's the Yuba Water Agency, which is the local water and electric utility.
And what was the purpose of the specific project that they had in mind for the Yuba?
So it's a forest restoration project. It includes some hand thinning, some mechanical thinning, some meadow restoration, prescribed burns, aspen regeneration. All of this was done before we were involved. And really, it's just looking at it's across about 15,000 acres in mm-hmm. Tahoe National Forest, mm-hmm. and just looking at the region and saying, what is it that this forest needs in order to return it to a healthier state?
Mm-hmm.
So it really is a kind of a mix of environmental interventions, all kind of under the umbrella of forest restoration. So the Forest Service benefits from this. It, for obvious reasons, and if we weren't involved, the Forest Service would be expected to pay for 100% of the costs. And they just, as we said earlier, they really just don't have the funds. And even if they do, it's going to take them 10 years to complete this project. Whereas if we bring investor capital and pay for it up front, we can do it in more like three years. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily sound like that much of a difference, but going from 10 years, if at all, to 3 years, that immediately decreases the wildfire risk and makes a huge difference. So the one beneficiary is the Forest Service. The other is the State of California. We have a couple different grant programs specifically for forest health here in the State of California, but they're done on a reimbursement basis, which means that the nonprofit, in this case, we're using the National Forest Foundation as our implementation partner. If they get this grant to do forest health treatments in the Yuba watershed, but they have to spend the money before they get the money back. So National Forest Foundation is a very well-resourced NGO, but there are a lot of nonprofits that don't have the balance sheet to pay for this on their own, and banks won't lend it to them. So if you have a $4 million grant, but you only have $20,000 in your bank account, then you're not putting that full $4 million. You're spending $20,000, you're waiting for the reimbursement, you're spending $20,000, you're waiting for the reimbursement, and then the restoration season's over. And the grant expires in 5 years. So whatever you don't use in those 5 years, you lose. So it's another instance of using investor capital as a way to really catalyze this work being done now as opposed to later.
So they don't have to do a reimbursement-based a scheme? They can appeal to the investment before they actually have to spend it, before they get the money?
So what happens is National Forest Foundation will hire restoration crews to do the work. The restoration crews will get started. And then the Forest Service and NFF will certify that the work is done. And instead of using NFF's own pocket to pay those restoration, then they will use our investor capital.
I see.
And then they will submit it for reimbursement. Then, 3-6 months later, whatever it is, that gets reimbursed and we pass it back to investors.
I see.
It's a win for NFF because they don't have to dip into their own bank account. It's a win for the restoration crews because they don't have to necessarily wait 3 or 6 months to get paid if NFF wants to wait for it to get reimbursed from the state first. And it's a win for investors because this is a really low risk investment. The money is already appropriated by the State of California. It's sitting in an account all you really need to do is spend it, and then it gets sent back to you. So it's almost like a bridge financing.
I see.
Investors really like that. So that's the California as the beneficiary. And then the last is the Yuba Water Agency. They are a water and electric utility, and they rely on the Yuba watershed for their water. And their water is not just for people to consume, but also for electricity generation, since they have hydro. And they're really concerned about the wildfire risk in their watershed. In the last 8 years, wildfire risk tripled. And there's not much they can do about it because they don't own this land. It's National Forest System land. And even if they did own the land, or even if they did want to start a partnership with the Forest Service, they don't have the money to do it all themselves anyway. So this is a really win for them because they've committed a certain amount of money over the next 5 years to reimburse investors, and they're only paying for a portion of the restoration work, but they get all the benefits as if they were to pay for it themselves.
Okay, so you've got three groups here, quite apart from Blue Conservation,
mm-hmm.
Blue Forest Conservation itself, which is at the hub, right? You've got the investors,
mm-hmm.
you've got the beneficiaries who mm-hmm. are actually probably the proposers of the project, and you've got the implementation partners.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the implementation partners have been pre-selected, or they're selected by the beneficiaries?
Selected by the beneficiaries, okay. The Forest Service.
Okay. And
yeah.
then you manage, administer, and flow the resource base that comes with that bond, right?
Exactly.
Okay. And that's the Forest Resilience Bond.
That
model could be applied to multiple areas, Lee.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to think about some of them, what could they be? I mean, I can think of many of them. As you know, we're both in the energy and the ag world, and we do a lot of work in the life sciences as well. But
yeah.
let's say in agriculture, for example, mm-hmm. what are some of the things that we can look forward to this kind of a model being used for?
Yeah, so I think there are a lot of opportunities on the ag side. You hear of drip versus flood irrigation, and flood irrigation uses a lot of water, and it's not necessarily even best for the plants. Drip irrigation uses a lot less water and can even have a higher yield. But making that change for farmers requires a lot of capital, and also requires that they don't plant for a season and they have some downtime. So using investor capital to pay for that upfront and maybe subsidize that first year or two while the yield is still getting back to normal or even better, I think could be a really great use for investor capital and have a ton of impact. And, you know, we're talking with the Bureau of Land Management to do what we're calling a rangeland resilience bond. So not just doing this in forest land, but doing this in rangeland. We've gotten questions about restoring fish habitat, meadow restoration. I think there really are a lot of applications to this model that we hope to explore, and we hope to help others explore as well.
Well, it's another source, not just of capital, but of a collaborative kind of capital infrastructure approach
mm-hmm.
that is not necessarily has not necessarily been used in the context of these kinds of projects before, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very different kind of way of operating.
Mm-hmm.
Given these new kinds of concerns that we have around food and agriculture, around energy and so on. So
absolutely.
Really remarkable. Well, one last question, Lee, before we end here today. What is your biggest wish for the future of the company that you run
mm-hmm.
and for the kinds of projects that you are seeing over the horizon? What is your biggest, if you were to take away something that says, in the next 5 years, we will be doing X. What is that?
I really want to just keep doing what we're doing, but on a much bigger scale. $4 million project is great. We're super proud of it. It checks a lot of boxes and is a lot of firsts for us and for the market in general. But California alone, we need over $8 billion invested just to protect our forests. So $4 million is obviously
a
drop in the bucket. So we want to keep doing what we're doing, but just doing it a lot more and a lot bigger scale.
Great. Well, thank you. Lee Madera from Blue Forest Conservation.
Thank you so much.
A remarkable innovation in finance that goes well beyond project finance and approximates a sort of bond finance that we have all become used to in the broader infrastructure world. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you, Rohit.
LARDA is proud to have Blue Forest Conservation as a participant in our USDA Commercialization Assistance Program. For more information about their work, please visit blueforestconservation.com. Thanks for listening to Ideas Energized, now available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Subscribe now for more thoughtful exploration of innovations in science, technology, the environment, and everything in between.